I really hate that there's this idea that if you're not sleeping, if you're working all-nighters, if you're hopping from plane to plane and city to city, that that is an indicator of success.
Welcome back to Series 10 of 40 Minute Mentor, the podcast on a mission to raise aspirations and inspire the next generation of category-defining founders. From purpose-led entrepreneurs to Olympic champions, you'll learn firsthand from today's successful leaders on what it takes to be brilliant, all in just 40 minutes. Today's 40 Minute Mentor is the brilliant Nina Mahanty, the co-founder of Bloom Money, a fintech bringing familiar financial services to migrant communities. As a daughter of immigrant parents and having herself moved to France, Austria, and the UK, Nina created Bloom based on her own lived experiences. She's a firm believer in improving monetary literacy to rethink the way customers interact with financial services, and I can't wait to dig into her story and journey with Bloom Money so far. Hear all about their recent pre-seed fundraise and what the future holds for them. So, Nina, welcome to 40 Minute Mentor. How are you?
I am doing well. Thank you so much. Hello from sunny Nashville, Tennessee, where I just happened to be for this recording. Delighted to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure is all mine. And I think that is a first for the podcast. I don't think we've ever had a recording in Tennessee. So this is already exciting.
Yeah, very exciting.
No, I'm really looking forward to this. And it was Amadeep Palmer from the BayHQ that kindly connected us. And I heard your episode on his podcast and was like, we have to get Nina on. Her story is so inspiring and right up our street in terms of full of mentorship and advice. So I can't wait to get into your story. But before we do that, we're going to give you a few warm-up kickoff questions. Question one, I grew up wanting to be...
I grew up wanting to be a ballerina and an astronaut. A ballerina in space, perhaps, would have been better.
Wow, what a combo.
Yeah.
Love that. I'm assuming you haven't yet applied for NASA, but were you a ballerina when you were growing up?
I did indeed. I trained in ballet for 17 years, although it doesn't look like it anymore. But unfortunately, really just struggled with chemistry and physics more broadly. So sadly, my career as an astronaut never really took off. But the ballet I did pursue as an amateur ballerina once upon a time.
Amazing. So that's awesome. You went some way to fulfilling that dream. I love it. The last time I was scared was when?
The last time I was scared, it was this morning as I was looking at payroll. And I think we can get into that as an entrepreneur, especially early days, everything is very fragile. And I think as a leader, you want your team to always be in a really great position and to keep the lights on and keep bills paid and everything. But it is always daunting. I don't think it really matters how big you get. There's just always going to be that quick feeling of like, you know, how's payroll looking this month? So that was the last time I was scared.
So true. Hey, I think that is something that a lot of people listening to this will be able to relate to. I definitely have been able to over the years. Next question. The most memorable day in my career was?
Oh my gosh. I feel so lucky to have done so many interesting things, but the most memorable day of my career so far has nothing to do with fintech, was meeting Michelle Obama when I worked at the US Embassy in London.
I mean, that's hard to top. We have a question at the end about who would you always want to be your mentor? And Michelle has come up a number of times. That's definitely a memorable day. Okay, from memorable to failures, my biggest failure to date is?
My biggest failure to date? Oh, there's so many. It kind of depends who you ask. I think I still have a chip on my shoulder about the fact that I wasn't offered a position on a grad program very early on in my career. And it really affected my self-esteem. But I don't think that that is the failure necessarily. I think the failure was and remains how it has kind of followed me around. And I view it as a failing that I have not internalized it and processed it yet to come out the other end and have taking it as a learning experience. I'm trying. I go to a therapist. I have a coach. But it's something that, you know, especially when you're young, it really affects your self-esteem. It affects the way you think of yourself in the world. And so it wasn't the not getting the job offer on the grad program. It was more my inability to process it in a healthy way.
I appreciate it. I think that's really honest of you. And I'm sure there are others listening to this that have been through something similar. I think we're all maybe a bit guilty of putting a huge amount of emphasis on those types of things, the school you went to, the university, the grad scheme. And of course, it's not to take away from anyone that goes on it. But I think one thing I've learned, I think from this podcast as well, is that there's a lot more to careers than those big brands and accolades. And you've clearly gone on to achieve a hell of a lot in your career. So I'm looking forward to exploring that in a minute. And a final question in the quickfire is, if there was one thing I could change about entrepreneurship, it would be...
If there is one thing I could change about entrepreneurship, it would be hustle porn and hustle culture.
Amen.
I really struggle with this. I really hate that there's this idea that if you're not sleeping, if you're working all-nighters, if you're hopping from plane to plane and city to city, that that is an indicator of success. And like this always be on, never have your out of office on, always respond to an email within an hour type of culture. It has been really detrimental to me as a founder. It has been very detrimental to people I love and care dearly for. And I think, especially in the venture-backed space, there is this idea that like you have to be this person like Adam Newman or, you know, any number of founders who, you know, wake up at 4 a.m. and they do their bullet coffee and then go for like a 10K run or whatever. And I'm just here to tell you that that is so harmful to us. And it really enforces a really unhealthy approach to both personal and professional life. So that is what I would change.
I couldn't agree more. And as somebody that has spent most of the last week off at the Rugby World Cup and then at a wedding and taking my dad to his 70th birthday at the cricket, I've kind of had my out of office on for the best part of 8 or 9 days, and it's been absolutely glorious. And there were, I'll be honest, 2-3 years ago, that would never have happened. I would have probably bought a ticket for my dad and not gone. I would have said no to the chance to go to the Rugby World Cup in France, because how could I possibly take 3 days off from working? And the wedding, I would have gone and would have been distracted because I would have been on my phone. So I've learned the hard way from burnout and just, I guess, perspective. And I think that's one of the things we really tried to share on this podcast, is just how damaging that sort of that whole hustle culture has been to so many people. And I really appreciate you saying that, because I think we need to keep that message going out there, because especially there's a lot of aspirational founders that listen to this. It's not the way to go. And we can both attest to that.
We can all vouch for it.
Exactly. Coming on to your background then, Nina, and thank you again for being so open already. Before we come on to Blue Money and how it started, let's talk a bit about your upbringing. So what was that like? Were you always destined for entrepreneurship? Tell us a bit more about the early life of Nina.
So I grew up in the Silicon Valley, which is hence the accent. And yes, people do grow up in the Silicon Valley. My parents were dot-com boom engineers. My father's Indian, my mother's Taiwanese, and they met working at a startup in the Silicon Valley. So some things just never change. I mentioned that my parents are immigrants because it has very much affected my mindset, is affected my upbringing. It has affected my career trajectory in quitting my job to build for immigrants. And I guess I would say I lived a very, very privileged upbringing. I'll first start there. I used to often think, and you, when you're a child, you don't really know. We very much lived like this immigrant, very stereotypical, penny pinching. If we go out to eat, which was rare, to a restaurant, it was like, you're not ordering drinks. You're getting tap water and that's it. We reuse the ice cream tubs for Tupperware. Those immigrant children all know the blue Royal Danish cookie tin that would double as a sewing kit. And that was definitely my upbringing. And to this day, we hold on to cars for like at least a decade. I think my mother's car is 21 years old now, and she still drives it. Thank you, Honda, for that, for building a trusty and dependable car. But it very much affected my mindset, because I also grew up in a very wealthy town. And when, as I say, you're young and you don't really know better, you start to question things. And I know I was a bit of a brat, to be honest. I was like, well, why do, you know, my friends get to fly business class and they get to go to like Disneyland every summer, and they get to go to like Legoland or to Hawaii every summer and sit business class when they do it? And my parents were like, that's great for them, but we're saving up to go home to India so you can see your family or your cousins or whatever. Or we're saving up for you to be able to go to uni. So that's why we're not paying for you to sit first class or business class. And so I mention all of this because I think many of us with a great deal of privilege don't really realize it in the moment. And like, there is a moment where someone points it out or something happens where you realize that. And I am lucky that early on my mother and my parents are very, very kind-hearted and very adamant about giving back to the community. And so from a young age, we volunteered. I was a Girl Scout. We always gave back where we could. And that's very much informed who I am as a person. Given that I am half Indian, half Taiwanese, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And for those of you that maybe come from Asian or immigrant households, you know that the options are like to be a doctor or a lawyer, or maybe these days like a software engineer. And I didn't want to be either. So I thought I would go to uni to become a diplomat. And I actually did start my career in the diplomatic corps with the Foreign Commercial Service. But it was really just a complete lack of really knowing what I wanted to do. And it was kind of, you come from this multicultural background, you speak multiple languages, I guess diplomacy is where you should go. And I had interests in international relations more broadly. But I was definitely, it was kind of like in the dark, padding about, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I would argue that is still the case. But hopefully that gives you a better picture of who I am and the context from which I am building and leading.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, it's so funny. I mean, my father's Indian and was born in India and moved over here in his kind of, yeah, sort of seven, I think. And it was so, his dad was a doctor. And I guess there was probably a degree of pressure to follow suit or similar types of industries. And he went to study law at university and then hated it. And then became an accountant, which is a tick in the Asian profession. That's a good one. And then he hated it. So he became a teacher. And so he never passed on that sort of pressure to me. But I know so many friends and family that have that. No, that's so awesome. And I know that you went on to work in fintech and you really know your stuff when it comes to fintech. I've got to ask, what attracted you to the world of fintech originally?
So I'll be completely honest, and hopefully this will reassure some of your listeners. I did not choose fintech. Fintech chose me.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I did a master's degree. And during that time, we all had to do kind of like a summer internship. You can think of it as like an MBA associate placement type of thing in between the 2 years. And where I did my master's, we were all, I won't even say gently pushed, we were all like very roughly pushed towards investment banking and consulting. And for many of us, in fact, most of my dear friends who I'm currently on this trip with, none of us have ended up in investment banking or consulting. Although, you know, we all kind of have very zigzag careers. I have probably a rejection letter from every consulting firm and every investment bank in the City of London. And I just desperately needed a job. And I was getting down to the wire. I needed to interview for something. And someone said, have you considered applying to this position at MasterCard? And it was a role with their digital payments team. I didn't know what MasterCard really did. I was familiar with the fact that they are important for us to make card transactions. I am an American, so I grew up with MasterCard priceless adverts on the television, but I didn't really know what they were. I thought they were a bank, which they're not. And I went in to interview and magically somehow was offered the job. So when I say fintech chose me, it was not like a clear, I want to end up in fintech. It was just like, this is how the chips fell. And from there, I really fell in love with it. And it was quite quickly, it just happened to be like very serendipitous that I ended up being in the right place at the right time. And it was when the early fintech, B2C fintech companies like Revolut, Monzo, which was then Mondo, and Starling, and et cetera, were starting out, and they were all building on the MasterCard rails. And so it was very formative to be there. But that is how I fell into fintech, completely by accident.
Love that. And I guess it's a perfect segue into talking about Blue Money. So for those who haven't come across the business so far, do you mind telling us a bit about the origin story, where the idea came from, why you chose to focus on migrant communities, and a bit of, I guess, about what the business actually does today?
Yeah, absolutely. So Blue Money is a fintech company serving diaspora communities or migrant communities, whatever you want to call these communities. And our mission is to accelerate the transfer of intergenerational wealth. What that really means in practice is that there are millions of immigrants across Europe who are very underserved by the financial system. I should say hundreds of millions. And it is growing over time for many, many reasons. And one of the things, I guess it was a convergence of personal and macro forces that really planted the seed, if you will, of Bloom, pun intended. And the first was, I come from an immigrant household. I watched my parents send money home my entire life. In fact, my dad used to take me to a hole-in-the-wall Western Union to send money home to India. And so I remember that need, that cultural duty and obligation to send money home. On the other hand, I was working at these really cool companies. At the time, I was at Klarna. I had worked at Starling Bank at that point. I had really racked up my bona fides in fintech. And what frustrated me was that most of the propositions that I was building were innovative and cool and interesting, but they weren't solving a problem for people who could most benefit from fintech. And so me being obsessed as I am, I was very interested in the intersection of migration and financial services. I started speaking to anyone that would speak to me, and I would just ask them, like, is the financial system serving you? Short answer, no, across the board. And so that's really where Bloom was born out of. What I did find was a very constant refrain, which was people taking part in informal financial systems. So I said our mission is to accelerate generational wealth. There's this misconception that immigrants, especially low to medium income, are poor, that they don't have money. There are often some really terrible political tropes that immigrants are coming here and leeching off the benefit system or whatever it may be. But what we find over and over is that immigrants tend to be very, very hardworking, and they do have money. They actually have incredible purchasing power. It's just that a lot of it is being sent home abroad, right? And so what I tried to figure out is, how can we balance the fact that people have this cultural familial duty to send money home, but also they need to care for themselves financially where they are. And so we found this one behavior that is very common. Depending on your culture, you may know it as different names. So in India, we call it chit funds. In Taiwan and in China, we call it hui in Mandarin, but my Nigerian friends call it ajo or isusu, depending on where they're from. Somalis call it hegbad. A lot of Caribbean folks call it pardna. And there's just so many different names for it. Everyone's doing it. People might also know it as kamiti if they're Bangladeshi, Pakistani, Jamaya in Arabic. Everyone's doing it, is the short of it. And it's all done really informally, which also means that because it's done informally and cash-based, this data of people paying in money regularly on time is not being captured by anyone. And so that's really where we set off. It's where we started. We are regulated now as an EMI distributor. Our app is in both app stores. So it's been really exciting to be on this journey and working towards that longer term goal of building intergenerational wealth.
Absolutely amazing. Love the mission. And I know that in a short amount of time, you've achieved a lot, including getting regulated. So do you mind telling us a bit about what your personal highlight has been of the journey so far? I have to then ask, of course, the opposite of what have been the hardest bits, what have been the harsh founder lessons you've learned, from the journey?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the highs you know, when we launched, it's actually really funny now that I'm catching myself. As an entrepreneur, as a founder, especially of a venture-backed company, I have found this with my friends as well, who also have raised venture. You often don't celebrate your wins and you fixate a lot on the losses, unfortunately. And I spent so much time thinking about the next thing. So even when we got appointed as an EMI distributor, I was like, right, what's the next thing? We didn't celebrate that. When we closed our funding round, I didn't even celebrate. It was like, okay, what's the next thing? When we launched in the app stores, I was a bit better this time. And we did celebrate as a team, but it was a very conscious effort. So I think the highlight was officially launching in both app stores. A more recent highlight, I think the thing that always motivates me is just being around the team or being around customers, one or the other. And with the team in particular, we had a really great session actually just last week where we were discussing some research that one of the team members had done on the jobs to be done within our customer base. And I just loved it because I kind of sat back and just let everyone chat and ask questions. And everyone was very engaged. Everyone was asking very interesting questions. Everyone was bringing their own lived experience to the conversation. And in that particular group of people, we have an incredible, our ops manager was literally born in a refugee camp. We have a Sudanese refugee who is currently volunteering with us while he waits for his asylum to be granted. We've got people who were like, one of our engineers is a child of missionaries who is South Korean, but actually lived in Egypt for a while. And so you just have this really beautiful mixture of people. And that has definitely been a highlight. The low light part in the shadows, I kind of touched on it already, is the, I hate to say self-care, that's not really the right word, but I think when you are building a business with really big ambitions that's venture backed, and you're very early, tiny team, especially as a founder, you take on a lot. And I just wasn't listening to my body. I wasn't listening to my head, and quickly burnt myself out within just a few months. I remember, you know, having a meltdown and just like bursting into tears for no reason. It was like something to do with flyers and they had like misprinted something. And I was at home and it was late at night and I was just like, you know, like F this, and just broke down. And so I think it's something that we don't talk about as much because it's not glamorous. You know, the number of times where, yeah, sure, you're like jumping city to city on the conference circuit or fundraising. What you don't see is like the really early flights, getting up at 3 a.m. to catch a 6 a.m. flight because it was £100 cheaper than like an afternoon flight, which would have been much easier on your body, but here you are taking it. Or right now, yes, I am hopping around the U.S. and I'm fundraising. And so what that means is I'm balancing both UK, European hours and the U.S. hours that I'm currently in, and trying to be present with my friends. And like, you know, as you said, the wedding that you're at, I'm going to a wedding this weekend, wanting to be present and fully there. But also in the back of my head, there's constant like, oh my God, the forecasts need updating and all that stuff. So
yeah,
it's such a wide spectrum.
The juggle is real. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's so true. No, well, thank you for sharing again. I think we owe it to all early stage founders and aspirational founders that just to tell it how it is. And it is difficult, and it is worth it if you believe in if you have a vision and a mission like you do. It's worth the hard work and sacrifices. But yeah, we do all have to look out for ourselves, and that's why I find sometimes having great mentors or advisors to sometimes just call me out and tell me to stop or in my case it's often my wife just saying like, things won't fall over, the business won't fail if you don't send that email or if you switch off an hour earlier. And I just need that constant reminder sometimes just when I'm in the thick of it. I want to hear about the future of Bloom Money, because you've built something incredible already, getting some great traction, mm-hmm. You're fundraising at the moment. Going through that VC fundraising, which we'll probably come on to talk about a bit later, is a very intense, but it's often because you have a big vision and you need the funding to kind of achieve that vision. So what is that big vision and what exciting things have you got coming down the line that you can tell our audience about?
Yes. As I mentioned, our mission is about building the intergenerational wealth. And what excites me about Bloom is the potential for us to just, I mean, it's actually terrifying sometimes. And I have to remind myself, sometimes that you are venture-backed for a reason, because the VCs believed and do believe that there is a large enough opportunity here for venture returns. So on the one hand, I'm very excited from a product development perspective. We're doing a lot of work where we are building very specific products, versions of cousins of existing financial products. So imagine an investment product, but how can we make that work for someone who is of diaspora, who has multiple bank accounts across multiple countries, who has different obligations to send money to various places? How do we think about investment or savings in that particular context so that it's not necessarily groundbreaking, but the way in which the customer experiences that will be very different? I'm very excited to do things as little as translate the app and have content available in different languages. We often talk about financial literacy as, you know, understanding what works in personal finance and what doesn't, and understanding your own finances. But what we talk about less is the literacy part. And literacy is fluency in a common language, which for us in the UK is English. But if you are an immigrant, oftentimes English is maybe your second, third, fourth language. And so how can we actually make sure that we're giving everyone tools that they can understand in a language that they prefer? So that's really exciting as well. And I think further afield, I'm just very excited to get onto the European continent as well. I think many people will have noticed over the past 5-10 years that the demographic makeup of Europe is changing. And that freaks a lot of people out, so much so that there are full political parties dedicated to it. But the truth of the matter is, this is not going to change. We have a declining birth rate and declining population across Europe. Someone has to do the work. Oftentimes, that's immigrants. To quote Hamilton, immigrants, we get the job done. And also, you know, you add in every other possible reason, and key among them is climate change. People will move, and they are moving, and they are coming into Europe. And so what that means is there's a huge opportunity for us to bridge that tradition, that cultural connection to home, while still giving people a fighting chance where they are when they are abroad. And so I'm very excited to do that. And we also know that, like, immigrants, frankly, add a lot to their local economies, whether it is through employment and doing jobs that oftentimes, like, from the very one end of the spectrum, doing jobs that people don't want to do, all the way to the fact that, like, I think there was something like maybe more than half of unicorns in the UK were founded by immigrant founders. And so immigrants start businesses. And even if it's a mom and pop shop doing a grocery store or haircuts or whatever, that is adding to the local economy. And so we're very excited to be a growth engine for that.
Yeah. I can't think of a more important mission, to be honest with you, as a son of an immigrant that came to this country. And I know many friends and broader family as well that have benefited from being accepted, and but have also given a ton back. And I think it's really important for us to support companies like yours that are really pushing the agenda forward. You mentioned fundraising, and you've raised from the likes of January Ventures, Octopus, Pact, and a number of amazing angels, which is no mean feat and says a lot about their belief in what you're building. We know, and we've spoken to many female founders on this podcast about how challenging their experience has been compared to male founders, and it's even harder for founders of color. So when you are a woman from an underrepresented background raising VC funding, you are up against it from the outset. So how has your experience been, and what do you think needs to change to sort of level this playing field?
Yeah, I won't sugarcoat it. It was awful. Fundraising for the first time and doing it again, it gets better over time. The more established you are, the more you understand the rules of engagement. When you come in as a first-time founder raising venture capital, no track record whatsoever to speak of. You're really leaning on your own CV, really, to get you through the door. I was very fortunate in that, and I had a lot of friends who were willing to make introductions. So I didn't really need anyone to matchmake for me, but it was brutal. It was the worst thing I've ever done in my life, to be completely honest. And it's a really frustrating experience because it is the job of venture capitalists to seek outsized returns. And they are not going to find outsized returns in something that has been done before, which is why I find it so perplexing that they keep investing in the same teams, the same products over and over and over. And what is really frustrating and was particularly frustrating for Bloom was we are building for a demographic that most VCs do not understand. I mean, we literally had a guy who said, I don't know any immigrants except for the guy that runs the kebab shop down the street from me. And you're kind of going, mate, you live in London. What do you mean? And so it was very difficult to hear people asking, like, are there immigrants in the UK? Do they have money? And you're almost being like inadvertently gaslit, especially when you're building something that they don't necessarily understand, which I hear is often the case for a lot of like femtech or consumer companies, where you have that typical male VC who's like, oh, I'll ask my wife or my assistant if this is a problem that she faces. And so it was very frustrating. I think as well, it's an uncomfortable realization for many people, especially if they are white, that like, there is this demographic shift that is happening, regardless of your politics, like it's happening. And that was very often uncomfortable for people to swallow. And then the other thing is like, I'm a woman, right? So it's the questions that I got were just hilarious. And it's like, oh, what are you going to have children? And do you think you have what it takes to build a $1 billion business? And it's like, I don't know. Do you ask that to male founders? One guy asked, do you have the killer instinct? And it's like, yeah, actually, I used to work with the Department of Defense. I have a really fine-tuned killer instinct, actually. But are you asking that to other founders who are not women?
It's terrible. It's actually terrible that you were asked those questions. But this is not the first time I'm hearing this. And that's even more depressing. And I know it won't be the last time this comes up on the podcast. But it's horrendous, really, isn't it? Especially in this day and age. What advice do you have for others that are going through this right now then? Because you've been there, but you also have found the good guys or the good women, the good VCs that have actually seen they've got it, right? But that's not everyone. So what can you say to somebody that's in this position at the moment?
So actually, I'll back up first. We'll start with saying that a majority of our cap table is women. About 50% of our cap table is people of color, and about 50% are first or second generation immigrants. So that was very purposefully done. Because the other thing you have to think about when you're fundraising is the nature of the capital that you're taking. And who are you going to make rich? If you're placing a bet and this thing goes gangbusters, who are you going to make rich? And for me, I wanted to make women rich. I always want to make women rich, but I also want to make people of color and people from immigrant backgrounds rich as well. And that meant turning down a few term sheets. And so our fundraising process was actually a lot longer than I would have liked, but that's because I turned down a few term sheets. My advice is actually advice I'm going to pass on from my friend, Yvonne Bajela, who is a partner at Local Globe. She is British Ghanaian, and so she just inherently understood Bloom as the daughter of immigrants herself. And we were actually just talking about this current fundraise that I'm going into, and she was very kindly giving me some feedback on our deck. And she said to me, go where you are celebrated. And in that particular instance, what she meant was, if you're trying to serve Global South communities, maybe you reach out to funds or family offices or investment pools from the Global South, where you do not have to explain to them that this problem exists. You do not have to explain to them that these people exist, right? And so I think similarly, if you're in the femtech space, yes, I'm sure a man will understand. It's always wonderful to have allies. But if you can find a female VC who gets it, who, you know, if you're working on a menopause company and you find a woman that has been through the menopause, like obviously the conversation that you're going to have is going to be so much deeper and richer because they have that lived experience of going through the problem that you're solving, which also then leads into how do we make it better is to have more diverse capital allocators. If we have the same, no offense to them, like straight white men writing checks, I mean, their alpha is actually not that great. I think someone needs to tell them that, because when you keep investing in the same people, I don't know where you're expecting to find your alpha, your returns. And so when we get young people, people who are women, gosh, women, wow, get them writing checks. It will be fascinating to see the things that get funded, the things that will have impact beyond just that initial investment that is made. And so that's, again, why I'm like, let's get women very rich. Let's get people of color rich. I just want filthy rich women so that they can write tons of angel checks and seed the Ubers and the Facebooks of the future.
Love that so much. And Yvonne, we had the pleasure of inviting on the podcast not too long ago, and she's a shining light in the venture space of the sorts of investors that we want out there and doing incredible work. So yeah, I'm all for that. We've talked about how challenging it is fundraising, but it's also not the easiest industry. Fintech is not the easiest industry to get into as a woman as well. There's barriers there to be broken down. I know you're changing this in many ways because you've already alluded to how incredibly diverse your team is, which is something to be truly heralded and celebrated. But it's not like that for everyone. So what's your advice for any women listening to this that really want to get into fintech that are struggling? And what can we do, perhaps to learn from the work that you've done, to make this industry more inclusive and welcoming? And why should other fintech founders out there adopt your approach?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing is, if you're a woman or effectively not a straight white guy trying to get into fintech, it can be very daunting. The very beautiful thing about fintech more broadly, or the community in the UK, I think globally, actually, I mean, I rocked up to Taiwan like almost a year ago, and my friends connected me to a bunch of people, and they all were like very happy to meet me and like take me out, show me things, explain things to me. Similarly, when I was in India, you know, people want to help and they want to be inclusive and welcoming. They don't always know how to go about that. I kind of made it my business to push myself onto people early in my career. You know, you said that you heard me on Fintech Insider. I very much like, that was even just kind of by accident. Again, I didn't ask to be on Fintech Insider, but it was an opportunity that presented itself. And then I started networking off the back of that. You have to be open to putting yourself out there. And that might mean showing up to a networking event. I do run a quarterly Women in FinTech meetup in London. So if there's anyone that is interested, like, definitely find me on LinkedIn and follow along. And we'd love to see what the next one. How do we make teams more diverse, and why should we? Is part of it is, again, why are we constantly looking at the same pools of people? And also like referrals. I have a really difficult time with referrals because most people are going to refer people that are like them. I actually love when people ask me for referrals, though, because my network is going to be far more diverse than other people. So if you are asking for referrals, maybe go to a different pool when you are hiring. Maybe put it out there and tag some people who might have more diverse backgrounds than you. And I think it's not just about the hiring, it's also about retaining. We hear this time and time again for women, like, oh, it's a pipeline problem. There's not enough women in STEM. And it's like, no, actually, women are outgraduating, outpacing men in STEM fields in terms of university degrees in the Western world. The problem, I think, is that once they get through the pipeline, we have what I call the leaky pipe problem, which is that women are often falling out because they can't make childcare work, because they are harassed at work, whatever things that are faced. And so we have this leak and women fall out of it and that therefore don't have the chance to rise in the ranks, to become executives, to be filthy rich, to write those angel checks, to, you know, whatever, to become founders in their own right. So it's also about just being mindful of the workplace culture that you have, making sure that people feel supported. Yeah, well done. You've been able to hire a Black woman onto the team. What are you doing to make sure that she feels comfortable in that space? What are you doing to ensure that the people around her are not engaging in microaggressions towards her? Does she have an avenue to let off steam? Does she have someone that she trusts within the organization to have some real talk with and say, you know, someone said this really messed up thing to me, and it was awful. And then how do you go about rectifying it? Because that is how and why we are losing people. And frankly, like, why should we care? Because it is just good business. It helps your bottom line. I don't have to explain to you, you work in recruitment. The churn that people see in tech businesses costs them money. I think I read, or I was listening to a podcast, and it was like an advertisement for ZipRecruiter or something. And they were saying like the average company spends nearly $5,000 trying to hire a new person. And that's like, forget about just hiring and the cost of all of that. But what about training someone up? In my master's, our teacher banged home about asset specificity. And you've trained this person to use the copy machine, and now you're going to let them go. Like, you've trained them where the files are, where everything is. They're starting to build institutional memory, and then you lose them because of a stupid reason. It's good business. And I think we find with, as companies grow later stage, that is when culture comes to bite them in the ass. And we've seen it with, unfortunately, some fintech companies where they only thought to care about their recruitment or their talent, their culture by Series B, maybe. And they didn't make a conscious decision to do it all along. And that costs them.
So true. And actually, the best founders that I've seen take people and culture and creating an inclusive environment so seriously that they invest in a people hire way earlier than others, even if it's fractional, even if it's like an advisor, but they're thinking about it almost from the outset. And they build that into the team from early on. And I just think there's so much to be said for that, because you can't undo a lot of the things that often go wrong when people haven't thought about that early on. It can kill cultures, frankly, and you will definitely lose great talent. And as you said, that's a huge waste of time and money, which is pointless. Nina, I could honestly talk for ages, and I would love to ask way more questions, but we're sadly coming to an end. So we've got three wrap-up questions for you. This is 40 Minute Mentor. So if you could be mentored by anyone dead or alive, who would it be and why?
I would want to be mentored by Dame Steve Shirley. I think she is incredible. Incredible businesswoman in her own right, but I think she's taken such a humane and beautiful approach to the life that she leads through her philanthropic work. And there was an FT like lunch with that the reporter went to lunch with her, and she just seems like she has so much like gumption and fire. And I love that in women. So that is who I would choose.
Love that answer. And she is so apt because she turned 90 this week. What a great inspiration to us all. And she's still going strong, which...
Happy birthday to her.
Yeah, happy birthday indeed. Your penultimate question is actually as our mystery set of questions that we're doing this season. And they're sent from our audience. So can you pick one, two or three and we'll see what they've chosen for you?
Let's do two.
Okay, two. What needs to happen to make financial literacy more of a priority for people of all backgrounds?
Yeah, we touched on it with... the literacy point, right? And I'm obviously looking from a very specific lens with language. But I think, you know what, that also applies for like young people. I have a friend, Timmy, he's Mr. Money Jar on Instagram. He's incredible. And the way that he explains to you using like crisps, like different crisp bags to explain different interest rates or how that works is so accessible and so interesting to young people. And not just young people, like their parents as well, because our curriculum sadly is failing us. So I think we need people who are taking a fresh approach to how they speak about it. I have a bee in my bonnet about the fact that in financial services, we're the only industry where we make the customer speak our language. We're like, let me give you the small print, APR, blah, blah, blah. You would never ask a customer to get on an airplane and be able to fly the plane, right? So why do we do that in financial services? And that really frustrates me. So I think it's about accessibility and having more people talking about it, full stop. The more you talk about it, the more you're like, oh, you're putting how much into your pension? Like, what's your company matching you? I want to now read up on this and make sure that I'm in the similar boat as you.
I love that. Yeah. Let's cut the jargon and talk a bit more about it and make it more accessible. I love that. Final question, Nina. If there's one piece of advice that you'd like to leave our listeners with today, what would it be?
It's my go-to. I say it all the time, but I will say it again because it's always worth saying. If you do not ask, the answer is always no. The worst thing that can happen is someone says no or not right now. But if you don't put yourself out there, if you don't ask for it, you don't get. So may as well ask.
Very true. Great place to leave this. Thank you, Nina. For anyone who is sitting on something that they kind of had been scared to ask or just haven't got around to doing it, get out there and do it. It's a great message to finish on. Thank you so much for taking the time and being such a fabulous 40-minute mentor, and all the best with the fundraising and the rest of the year and years ahead. I'm excited to see what the future holds for you.
Thank you so much, James. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's all from us today, but do make sure you check out the links in the show notes for more on today's 40-Minute Mentor. And if you have any recommendations for future guests, then why don't you drop our Head of Marketing and 40-Minute Mentor producer, Hannah, a line on hannah@jbmc.co.uk. Thank you so much for your ongoing support, and I look forward to seeing you again next week for more pocket-sized mentorship.